Sebastian Striegel.
Ja, hallo und herzlich willkommen zu dieser Sonderfolge der großen Anfrage. Wir bleiben diesmal nicht in Deutschland mit unserer Gesprächspartnerin, sondern wir haben uns international verabredet. Ich habe meine Kollegin Katharina Schulze aus dem Bayerischen Landtag gefragt, ob sie nicht Lust hat, gemeinsam mit mir eine Veranstaltung, einen Talk around the globe zu machen mit unserer Kollegin Julianne Ganter aus Neuseeland. Wir wollen miteinander sprechen über die Pandemiebekämpfung in Neuseeland, die Unterschiede zur Pandemiebekämpfung in Europa und warum Neuseeland so erfolgreich ist. Und wir haben uns entschieden, dieses Gespräch, das wir miteinander geführt haben, hier auch als Sonderfolge im Podcast zu senden. Ja, herzlich willkommen zum grünen Webinar mit Katharina Schulze und Julianne Ganter hier bei Zoom und parallel auch bei Facebook. Wir wollen heute einen Talk around the globe miteinander veranstalten und haben uns vorgenommen, nach Neuseeland zu schauen. Wir wollen nach Neuseeland schauen, weil Neuseeland in den vergangenen Monaten viel, viel besser durch die Pandemie gekommen ist als die Bundesrepublik Deutschland, viel, viel besser als Europa und als viele andere Staaten weltweit. Und wir wollen fragen, was hat Neuseeland in den letzten Monaten anders, vielleicht auch besser gemacht? Okay, and I'll now change to English, and I would like to say a very, very warm welcome to New Zealand. Hello, Julianne Ganter. It's good to have you here in our webinar, and would like to talk this evening, or for you, it's the morning, with you about New Zealand's COVID response over the last month, really. And I think you're a very good expert for this, because you are a member of the New Zealand Parliament for the Green Party, and you are responsible for the COVID-19 response policies in your parliamentary group. And I think it's good to have you here tonight as an expert. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Kia ora from Aotearoa, New Zealand. As Sebastian said, I'm Julianne Ganter. I'm a Member of Parliament for the Green Party. And really, to talk about New Zealand's COVID response, I'll probably go back almost exactly 1 year, because that's when it really started. And 1 year ago, I was Associate Minister of Health in the government. I didn't have full responsibility for COVID-19, but as the health spokesperson for the Green Party, I was very involved. We had a coalition government of Labour, one other party, New Zealand First, and the Green Party. Now, since then, there was an election in October, and the Labour Party won a full majority. So the Green Party is no longer formally in government. Our two co-leaders are ministers outside cabinet. But at the time, about a year ago, I was a member of the government, and probably the most critical thing for New Zealand's response is we were lucky that we got cases a little bit later than places like New York and Italy. So we could see very clearly that they were having their health system completely overwhelmed. And that allowed us to take probably more drastic action than would have been politically possible if we had just been getting cases earlier. And so it was when we did the analysis, it was clear that we didn't have very many ventilators in the country. We don't have good capacity in our hospitals because, well, prior to the coalition government, we had 9 years of a more right-wing government that sort of ran down the health system, and that capacity had not been built up. So in preparing for our health system to be overwhelmed and to deal with this, it became very clear to the members of the government that we actually had to do whatever it took to stop a widespread outbreak from happening in the country. The other factor I think was really helpful for us is that we have some scientists who are really good at science communication, and they're kind of popular. They write for blogs, or they more popular journalism. And they used their science skills to and worked with some creative artists to put together information that really helped people understand what they needed to do to stay safe. And this is where the concept, I think, of a bubble came up. So they use really simple language, and they were advising our prime minister directly. So when it was about 1 year ago, I think, when we made the decision within about a week, firstly, that anyone coming into New Zealand would have to self-isolate for 2 weeks. But within about a week to 10 days, it became clear that that requirement was not sufficient. And so from that point, the government started setting up a managed isolation program where basically we said no one can come into the country unless they are a citizen or a permanent resident, or there's some exceptional special circumstances. And because New Zealand is a country that relies a lot on tourism, we had many hotels that were really going to be in financial trouble. But then this became kind of an asset. So we were using hotels then, and have been using hotels for a quarantine system. So anyone who comes into the country has to spend 2 weeks in a facility where they will have very minimal contact with anyone else. They will be tested for COVID-19 now 3 times. And there's very, very, you know, a lot of work goes around the managed facilities. So there's cleaning, the food and the laundry is all very carefully managed to minimize the chance of any spread of COVID-19. Then the most instrumental thing for us was our first lockdown. And because we had these scientists advising the government, and it became clear we couldn't afford to have a lockdown, and other countries were already having longer lockdowns, like Italy, the Prime Minister announced at a press conference that we would go into a level 3 lockdown. We have 4 levels, and 4 is the strictest. And we've only had the 4 that one time for about 7 weeks. And so she said within 2 days, everyone is going to have to stay home and self-isolate for at least a month. And she and our head of our health system, the Director General of Health, gave almost daily press conferences where they talked about the number of cases. They reminded people with very clear, simple messages to stay home, save lives. And there was a really, I think, good framing of it so that people felt they were all in a team together, working together. And this has led to a very high compliance rate with the lockdown. But we only in the end, that 4 week lockdown or 1 month lockdown ended up being extended to about 7 weeks. And then when we moved out of the 7 week lockdown, then it was into a level 3, which is still a pretty strict lockdown. So when I talk about level 4, I can send you the information on our public information on what level 4 meant. It meant no schools are open, no childcare. Only not even road construction can happen. The only essential workers who are allowed to go out and do work were people working in supermarkets, people working in healthcare, and even healthcare, it was quite restricted. So a lot of normal procedures were put on hold under level 4. It was only kind of the most urgent ones. And during this period, then health providers and schools had to pivot if they were able to try and do their activity online. And the governments also enabled like free educational programming on the main television stations. And there's a very big gym in New Zealand that is kind of famous for their classes going overseas called Les Mills. They put all their gym classes on television at prime time and online, so people could access all of this. And there was, we already had some development of mental health support available through the telephone or online, and so that was able to be used. So basically, it was a very, very strict lockdown, and this enabled us to almost eliminate cases in the community for quite some days before we went back to something more normal. And no takeaways at level 4. So you couldn't get a restaurant to make you food. You really just you could go to the supermarket. You could go outside once a day or twice a day for exercise, but you could not see other people. And I think on a framework that I've seen, New Zealand had one of the strictest lockdowns, but for probably the shortest period of time. And because we were able to eliminate COVID-19 in the community then, we were able to go back almost to normal life in June last year. There have been, I think, two or three community outbreaks since then that have come usually through the border. Because we eliminated COVID-19, we've been able to really dig into every case. So every case we have is genomically sequenced. And then if we have a community outbreak, they can link it. They can use the genome sequencing to try and figure out where it's come from, not just contact tracing. But I realize that in places with a more uncontrolled outbreak now, that would be very difficult, impossible. So we have had in August, we had another community outbreak, and we've never understood where that came from. And ultimately, I think it led to over 100 cases and 3 deaths. But what happened was, as soon as the government found out about it, they moved to a level 3 lockdown in Auckland, which is where it was, our biggest city, is almost 2 million people. So Auckland had to be in a level 3 lockdown, which again means if you can work from home, almost everyone has to work from home. There are some more essential services that happen. So road construction will happen at level 3. You can get restaurant takeaways at level 3, but otherwise it's very controlled. And children are still learning from home at level 3. So they're not going to school. And that was for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, that one in August. It ended up delaying our election, which was meant to happen in September. So that got delayed till October, but it worked. We controlled the outbreak very well. And then we were able to go back to level 1 by the end of September, well in time for the election campaign. And then since then, I think we've had 2 more, or really 1 more. It was sort of like we had a mini lockdown in Auckland for 3 days, and then we went back to normal for a week. This was in February, last month. And then it turned out there was more spread than they thought. And so we had a longer lockdown for about 7 days. But again, it's only level 3. So the main things I would say that have helped us was really clear communication, having really expert science advisors speaking not only to the leaders, but to the public, the elected leaders really fronting and being on the press conference every day. And many people at home more people would watch that daily press conference that was live streamed than even watch the primetime news. Having a very strict lockdown to contain it for about almost 2 months, but this was worth it because in the end we were able to go back to normal. There's no question that we have some easier time controlling the border than a country like Germany might have because it's an island. So, you know, everyone flying in from another country, and there are very few flights now, can be collected at the airport and managed in a quarantine system. However, there's always pressure to open up, to have more free travel with Australia or other countries, to allow, we have many New Zealanders live overseas or have family overseas. And so this has been seen as somewhat challenging that it's not easy for people to visit a sick family member here or to come home because you have to be able to get a flight, get a place in managed isolation. We can only accept about 300 or 350 people a day, which is not very many. However, it is about the same number that Australia is taking through their border, and they're 5 times bigger than us. So I think I should go to questions now.
Thank you very much. And I think this is in stark contrast to that, what we are experiencing in Germany at the moment. Our cases are going really flying up at the moment in most of the states, at least. And we are, I think, really in the flight into a third wave. Actually, our incidence rate is at slightly above 100 right now per 100,000 people. So it's quite a number of cases every day. And as Katharina, whom I also welcome now, she's a member of parliament from the Green Party in Bavaria. And as she already said, people here are always saying, okay, there's New Zealand, they're on island, they have it pretty easy. They just control who gets in or who gets not in, and then that's it. But what you are saying is it's quite a different approach. So just having the borders closed is one thing, but I think the most important thing I heard from you now is communication and listening to the science first as a precondition, and then communicating it, getting the message out. And I think I would like to ask Katharina at that stage if she's seen something similar in Germany as yet, or whether how are you looking at the situation here?
So thank you, Julianne, for the interesting input. It was really, really good to get to know even more what you in New Zealand are doing. And Sebastian, I would totally underline the importance of good communication. As a Green Party in Bavaria, we started to address this issue from the beginning, because we have a minister president, the head of our state, who always was talking like, I will protect you. I will fight for you against the virus. And I read a really interesting article of New Zealand where the journalist was writing, it was kind of a slogan, we against the virus, we 5 million against the virus. So I think this communication issue, making the people part of the fight against this virus, is totally important. So maybe I can pass my next question to Julianne and ask you, I mean, if you're telling us this now, it sounds wonderful. And I'm, as a German citizen, I'm like, oh, wow, I would be so happy if we would have this great communication people in our country who kind of empowering us as citizens to go down this road. So now my question would be, I mean, did really everyone like this kind of approach? I mean, it sounded from your input like, okay, I mean, 7 weeks hard lockdown was kind of not so nice, but everybody was kind of doing it. So did that really work, or were there kind of maybe only small groups who tried to push against it? And why didn't they succeed?
Let's jump in there and put a second question there, which was brought up here by the Initiative for Safe Education now. And they ask, I saw a press conference from New Zealand where an official briskly told a doubting citizen to just accept it and he won't accept any discussions. Was this common? And what did you do to convince these people?
So there were, from the beginning, skeptics of the lockdown approach, and we have a very right-wing media, and they, you know, were not always supportive of what the government was doing, but especially there were some epidemiologists or a few academics who made a group, and they contested what the other scientists and academics were saying. They called themselves Plan B, and they were arguing for like a herd immunity approach by letting the virus go uncontrolled in the country. But they weren't very persuasive. So I think, of course, there were people who were doubting, and maybe it's as many as 10% of people who were really angry and upset and don't trust the government. But I think that because the Prime Minister is a very good communicator, Jacinda Ardern, she's from the Labour Party, and she's a very good communicator. She's, you know, just fronted, and so is the head of the public health system. And both of them would just answer questions for about an hour a day, and they would just be really, really clear. And the vast majority, I think we had a higher rate of compliance with our lockdown than people expected in the government, because we don't think of New Zealand as high compliance country who likes following rules. This is not something that, you know, if you think maybe Taiwan or more South Asian countries, you would see they didn't have to have a strict lockdown because they wore masks and they really followed the rules. We didn't expect New Zealanders are used to being free and not being told what to do. So I think the communication was really, how did that happen? All I can say is having people who were willing to front, who were appealing to intrinsic values, the values of us all being together, not fighting a war or being tough or protecting you. It was more like, we can do this together. And that inspired people. But also, I think people could see what was happening in other countries and didn't want that here. And so that really helped motivate people.
And may I ask another question there? You mentioned the pressure opening up the border again because of families living abroad, wanting to look after their relatives and stuff like that. So how do you cope with that pressure? Because one thing we in Germany are facing is a very, very big problem is really that our prime ministers and minister president, they seem to be caving in to pressure nearly all the time. Of course there is pressure, and I understand that people are having quite a lot of difficulties and the situation isn't easy at all. But when you look at those politicians, they seem to be caving into pressure nearly all the time. And this is really frustrating. At least I find it really frustrating. So I would be interested in how are you coping with that pressure if things are coming up like that?
I think that, I can't, because I'm no longer in the government, I can't speak perfectly for how they are managing to continue. But I think that they are just, I think because we had the hard lockdown in the beginning and it's been successful, that they know most people realize this is a successful strategy and we don't want to put it at risk. And so just communicating that to people and being empathetic, I think being empathetic to, yes, this is really hard. It's terrible that you can't go see your loved one or go to your sister's wedding in Australia, or we know this is really challenging, but we have to do this to stay safe, you know, and prevent an we're not going to be in a better position if we have an uncontrolled outbreak of COVID-19. There have been some businesses that also complain anytime there's a lockdown, hospitality businesses. But the other side, I guess, of the government's response was economic support. So when we went into the lockdown, they put money out to any business or any employer that said that they needed money, and that and they increased the benefit social support that was available to people who lost their jobs due to COVID so that they could still pay their bills. And what this meant is we didn't have quite as an economic recession as was expected. But we have another problem, which is a different problem, due to a lot of quantitative easing from our Reserve Bank, we have a house price problem. Our house prices have actually been increasing at a very fast rate over the last year. And I think this is a different problem that the Greens are trying to inspire the government to do the right thing on. But I think probably making sure that people had that financial support to stay at home was also a big part of the solution. And if we hadn't had such a strict lockdown and we had to have ongoing financial support for people who couldn't go about their business as normal, that would have been much worse, much harder.
Kata.
Yeah. I think what you said, the topic empathy is really, really important, because we should not forget it's like an really exhausting, strange, new, heartful situation which the whole world is in. So giving people like the acknowledgement that it's not easy and that we know how bad and how tearful this whole situation is, I think, a really good start to kind of get the connection of, yeah, but if we want to change it, we have to do something. So I really like that you put the word empathy in it, because I think German politics is lacking empathy. And I think this is actually something which is really important and strong. I just wanted to add up and follow up question regarding children and their education. Because in Germany, we have the big debate about like security versus getting the chance to get an education, which is also a right, you know, and getting a good education. Not everybody has a family at home where mother and daddy or mother and mother or daddy and daddy have the time to do the schoolwork with the children. They're coming from different backgrounds. And I mean, if you're losing half a year or 1.5 years of your education, or if you're kind of in the last classes until you do your final year, and then this is something which affects you and the family and the children, of course, the teachers. So I would like to know, I mean, in the beginning, you didn't know that the lockdown was only 7 weeks. It could have been longer. So how was the debate about children, schools, and not bringing them to school? Or the other question is, did you have such a great digitalization that it was easy to put the school in the digital world? So maybe you can explain a little bit more about the whole education process and the situation.
I think it was hit and miss. You know, I think some schools and some teachers were well placed to go online, but not every school. And I think we had to make sure that every student had a device available, because not everyone in New Zealand would have an iPad or a laptop. So the government had to move quickly to try and get resources prepared in a way that could be sent to people. I think they even produced some resources that were hard copies were sent to people's homes. And I think it was quite challenging for, depending on the age of the children, for the parents who were trying to work at home. You know, with older kids, it's not so hard. I'm lucky, my child's only 2.5. So we didn't, you know, at the time he was 1.5. So we didn't have to worry about school. It was just me and my partner juggling work with no childcare and taking turns having Zoom meetings. But for people who had 2 or 3 children who are young, I think it was very challenging for them to work at home. And if your child is at kindergarten or first or second grade, especially, very difficult to transfer the education to online. You know, it wasn't easy, but again, I think if you could be sure that having a really strict lockdown and staying home for 2 months meant you could go back to living as normal, then it's worth it. And I know that, like, compared to friends who live in the States or elsewhere, their kid, you know, children haven't missed out on as much education. But yeah, so it's hard to say. All I would say is, if you've been in a kind of semi lockdown for 6 months or a year, I can understand that would be harder to continue. But perhaps if the lockdown was stricter for a shorter period of time, then you could be more open.
Yeah, that's a problem in Germany right now. We are in more or less a lockdown situation since months. People are very much wary of the situation. They feel frustrated. They can't see an end to it. And things are even getting worse at the moment. And I think all the models are predicting that it will get much worse in the next weeks or so. And they think, okay, what shall we do? And that's why I think quite a number of people are thinking, would there be a hard lockdown? Wouldn't it be a better option for like a 1 month, 2 month sort of situation where you get like really hard into lockdown? I think Germany hasn't been in a real lockdown as yet. There's always been many things which have been possible. Like you could always order food. You were like the whole workplace thing was not regulated very much up until now. It's just now that people are getting into their home offices quite more often than in the month before. So the situation is really, really, really very, very different. But I would like to come back to this communication thing for another time. We have a question here. If there have been any conspiracy theories in New Zealand, or are there people denying COVID altogether? Could you say something about that as well?
Yes, there are. I think there's a conspiracy that somehow COVID is related to 5G, or that this is all a plan of Bill Gates to force us to have vaccines that will then somehow control our RNA and DNA. there's some quite elaborate conspiracy theories. And interestingly, at the election, There were several very small political parties that have no representation in parliament that came up that really stood on these platforms of fighting the vaccine, fighting 5G, fighting the conspiracy. And they didn't get very many votes, luckily. But they had a lot of money. So I don't know where they got their money and whether some of it did come from overseas interests. Because some very small political party had a lot of signs and billboards everywhere. But they did not get many votes. So there's definitely a percentage of people, I would put at under 5%, who are really believing conspiracy theories. And some, you know, even quite reasonable people, maybe like Green supporters, who've been very skeptical about the lockdown approach, even though it's worked in New Zealand. So I find that interesting that they're so skeptical about the lockdown approach when clearly it has been successful here. But as you say, I mean, it has to be a full lockdown. Like, otherwise, COVID will continue to spread. People can't see the benefits of being locked down, and so they won't want to stick with it.
So hit fast and hit hard with a lockdown, and don't have it for like endless times.
Yes, and actually the Prime Minister had a line about this. It was go early, go hard. And this was one of the simple lines that was used initially to describe our response and to motivate people.
Okay, so I have a question relating to that as well. You mentioned the strict lockdown, the good organized lockdown as well. But what kept numbers down in New Zealand in the following month? How is no COVID working then in progress? And could you compare the situation to Australia?
Yeah, it's because we eliminated COVID in the community in our first lockdown. Then the only COVID coming into the country that we're aware of is through people coming through the border. And that's only about 350 people a day. There's no question that the risk of a community outbreak increased as time went by, because as COVID cases went up worldwide, then more people returning to New Zealand were likely to have it. And even we had some cases that were quite interesting, like a woman stayed in managed isolation for 2 weeks. And then after she left managed isolation with a negative COVID test, she got COVID 5 days later. But we're still using an app to do contract tracing. And luckily she had been very vigilant in using that app. So anytime you go somewhere, there's a barcode and you scan it. We don't have very high compliance on that barcode scanning, unfortunately, but it really helps the contact tracing teams. And then also, I think there's a Bluetooth option. So they were able to just do contact tracing around this woman. And they found two other cases who were in the same managed isolation facility as her at the same hotel in downtown Auckland. And they got sick after they left as well. And that what they found, I think, is that a new person who'd come to the hotel had had it, and somehow there had been a transfer to people who didn't have it when they went to the hotel. That was a very exceptional case, but it just shows basically by managing the cases, as soon as we know someone has COVID in the hotel for 2 weeks, then they get shifted to a different hotel with the people who have COVID. So we try to keep the people with COVID all in hotels together or the hospital. We haven't had that many hospitalizations actually, because the number of cases has been so low. And yeah, I hope that answers the question. Basically, anytime there's been an outbreak, they've managed to trace it at least to the first case we're aware of. I would say with the two outbreaks we've had since the big lockdown, where we had to do a level 3 lockdown in Auckland, the exact origin of those cases in the community has never been determined. And it's possible that there's some chain of transmission that is not person to person that we are aware of because we have so few cases. In terms of Australia, I think we've done similarly well to Australia. Melbourne has had to have many more lockdowns. They've had to have really, really long lockdowns. But there are other parts of Australia that have had almost no community cases. And Queensland, for example, is a state in northeast Australia, and they've had something very similar, very few cases, but they had to go back into a lockdown when there were some community cases for about a week, but then they've been able to open up. New South Wales and Sydney and Melbourne have probably had to have the most lockdowns and cases. And the problem with Melbourne, when they have had several months of pretty strict lockdown on and off. And I think they had a problem with their people working at the border, like working in the hotels that are the isolation hotels, were not really observing the strict protocol. And some of them are actually quite low paid, like security guards, and they might work as an Uber driver on the side. And so that's how they had more community spread.
Okay, there's another question towards Australia here. I listened to Stephen Duckett in an interview, and he was talking about travel bubbles with New Zealand and Australia. He said it is called a green zone with New Zealand. Is this still active or is this cancelled as for now?
It hasn't actually happened yet, but they're planning for it. So it was very close to happening, and then we had a community outbreak here. And so Australia cancelled the plan for it. The difficulty has been, I think, the logistics of ensuring that a flight has all people who are only coming from Australia and not transiting from somewhere else. But I think that the work is in train, and in April, our government will be making an announcement about when we might have a travel bubble. But it has not happened until now.
So this is something for the outlook, really, which could be dealt with in the next week or month or so. Okay, so there's another question here regarding strategy, and I'm not sure whether you can answer, but somebody asked here, what was the strategy from New Zealand different in relation to Taiwan or, for example, Singapore?
I'm not an expert on Taiwan and Singapore's response. I don't believe Taiwan ever had the same style lockdown we did. But I think they were much better at observing physical distancing and mask wearing. And so that's why they didn't have to have as strict a lockdown. I do believe Singapore had a lockdown. We tried to learn from their responses. And so when our government was coming up with the alert level system and the protocols, I know they were looking to Singapore and Taiwan, who have more experience with very acute respiratory illnesses that are very contagious with SARS and MERS. So I'm sorry, I can't speak to the total detail of what Singapore and Taiwan have done, but I think New Zealand tried to learn from them. And initially, we didn't have the evidence around mask wearing that it would be helpful. So we weren't asking people to wear masks, but that has changed. As the evidence has changed, we are now requiring people to wear masks on airplanes and in public transport is the main place where we're asking people to wear them. And during the lockdown, people were wearing masks when they went to the supermarket and if they're working in a managed isolation facility or stuff. We also had a shortage of PPE, like protective equipment, when this first started. And so there was quite a lot of work that had to be done to get the supply chain to make sure that we could continue to get everything we need, especially as global air travel was disrupted. This is disrupting our supply chain for many goods and many things that we are used to having easy access to in New Zealand. But the government put out some support for cargo flights.
And could people just use any mask, or are you requiring a special type of mask to be worn in public transport?
Right now, it's any type of mask, and it's usually a pretty simple one. It's not but that's because we don't have an outbreak. In the medical facilities, especially if we had a community outbreak, then essential workers and people working at hospitals, medical facilities would be having very high quality masks that are specialized and certain to protect against the spread of COVID. We're just having like a bit of fabric, you know, but that's because
community masks.
Yeah.
I have another question here. Who were the scientists who advised and worked out the strategy, and did they get any support from abroad, working together with other experts from other countries who may be experienced in pandemics?
I'm sure that they did get support from people overseas. The one who stands out most to me is a woman named Susie Wiles. She's not the only one, but she's one that was particularly good at communicating and was on social media, but also working with an illustrator. And she's not a specialist in viruses. She's actually a specialist in, she's a microbiologist, but she was still very good at science communication. And I think that was very helpful.
If I can just add in a follow-up question, we have in Germany a big debate about if the people who are working in epidemiology and medicine are taking too much room and if we don't need an interdisciplinary approach. So taking psychologists into account, economics, etc., etc. So if you're talking about experts who were advising the government, was it kind of only the medicine side, or did you have kind of a group of different experts from different fields who were working together?
That's a good question. I feel like maybe in New Zealand, because it's a small country, we have a lot of people who are already kind of multidisciplinary in their approach. But the interesting thing I thought is the chief science advisor to the prime minister is a woman. This Susie Wiles is a woman. Michelle Dickinson is a woman, and our prime minister is a woman. And I thought it was really interesting.
That
was very female dominated response. And we've also had, I think we took the line very early on that the best economic response is a public health response, so that it couldn't be framed as a trade off between the economy and health. I said, actually, the best thing we can do for the economy is to protect our people from getting sick.
Okay, and I have another sort of question here regarding the test strategy and also the vaccination. Is this a big topic as yet? You said you don't have much community cases as yet, luckily, but people here are asking about vaccination as well.
Yeah, so we have a vaccine strategy, and some people who work on the border have already been vaccinated. We weren't at the front of the queue for the vaccine compared to other countries. Like, we're not as far advanced as the United States or even the UK. But I think that's fair because we actually don't have many cases and we don't have an uncontrolled outbreak. Our government has announced that they've purchased enough of the Pfizer vaccine for everyone to have two of them. And so there'll be a strategy rolling out over the next few months for a mass vaccination program. And the real details of how we will have to motivate people to get vaccinated, if there will be some people who are hesitant, is not clear. I don't think we'll make it mandatory, but there may be some. Yeah, I can't say for sure what approach the government will take, but I think they will be looking for high compliance, high voluntary compliance, and using incentives to motivate people and to help them understand that it is safe.
Okay. And are you using strategic testing without any community cases as yet? Are you testing also within the
surveillance?
Yeah.
So testing was a big focus right from the beginning, and we had to get all the right materials to be able to do the tests. And there were times at which the testing capacity was limited, and so the government had to work really hard to make sure. Initially, we probably weren't testing enough because we were worried we wouldn't have enough tests, and we had to sort of ration them. But then as the supply of testing materials has ramped up, there's been very wide testing. People are encouraged to get a test if they have any symptoms. It's free for everyone. There's surveillance testing, and there's also surveillance of wastewater, although they're not sure how accurate that is right now because they're testing the wastewater from the hotel where they know people have COVID and it's not always positive. So they're not doing the saliva tests. It's the full swab that goes up your nose. I mean, they are doing saliva tests, but they're not using it instead of the full swab test. But I think they're trying to get to the point where they can do even more frequent saliva testing and use that to be sure that everyone at the border we know as soon as if they've picked up COVID.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's another question here. Did you perceive a great interest from abroad in learning from the New Zealand example and strategy, or not so much?
I think people have really been interested. I think it put us on the map a bit for our response. But I'd say that we're almost an unlikely country to have managed it really well because of the poor state we were in around the time COVID hit, which is one where we don't have as developed a health system as Germany does. And we didn't have all the PPE we needed. We didn't have very centralized systems for managing PPE or managing testing. But I think the government just took really good advice. And also, I should really shout out, I need to mention Ashley Bloomfield, who is our head of public health, has become almost a national icon. And he is someone, he happens to be a medical doctor with a degree, a PhD in public health as well. And so he's a real specialist in epidemiology. And he has taken over as the head of the health system maybe a year and a half before this COVID outbreak. And so, and he's been an excellent communicator, but also someone who really had the knowledge and ability to take the right advice and give the right advice to the politicians.
Okay. And could I ask, I don't know the New Zealand political system too well. So are you doing everything what you did on the state level, or are the city?
We don't have a state. We're only the size of a small state. It's only 5 million people. So we only have we do have a central government, and then we have municipal local government for the city and maybe regional, but the regional government is only looking after things like public transport or water regulations. They're not, we have a district health boards. So there's about 22 different regional health bodies for our public health system, but mostly it's had to be directed from central government.
So a more direct approach. So I have another question here, and you started talking about this early on already, but maybe you could dig in further there. Do you think that depression is becoming a problem now in New Zealand? In my family, 3 people started needing therapy because of mental illness due to COVID, and I was wondering if the same thing happened in New Zealand.
I can't speak to the exact numbers, but one thing that is very interesting is that during our lockdown period, it looks like our rates of suicide went down.
Same here.
Which some people were saying they would go up, but they did not. They went down. And I think it's because people, even though they were home alone or just in a small bubble, they felt a sense of solidarity and purpose with the group in responding to COVID-19. It is possible that depression and anxiety have altered somewhat during the year, but I can't speak to what the rates are. I think because we've been able to go back to living normally most of the last year, and there's been financial support for people, I think we've probably done okay. There's one thing I just thought I should mention, and I wasn't sure if Germany has done this. Because we're a small country, we did have to restrict people's travel between the two islands and really between different regions of New Zealand when we have a lockdown. Australia stopped travel between states early in their response. And I think that has opened up more, but sometimes it gets shut down. Like if Melbourne and Victoria have a big lockdown, then there's no one can travel into or out of Melbourne. And I was just wondering if in Germany there's been restriction in the lockdown in traveling around the country, because I think that would be pretty critical to stopping outbreaks.
Kata wants to answer that.
Yeah, I mean, we're having this discussion a lot because, as you mentioned, we are in the middle of Europe. We don't have 5 million people. We have over 80 million people, and we are in an Europe which we are very proud that we normally don't have border controls, you know? So this is a big debate, also political. What do we want to have? We have a lot of families who one person is living in one country and the other in the other country. So there's also, I mean, there are many aspects to bring into account, but we don't have in Germany the rule that if there is, I don't know, a high number of cases in one area, then the people are not allowed to go somewhere else. And so that's why I would like to ask you, was it just kind of a rule which everyone was, which everyone followed? Or did you have kind of, I don't know, military or police standing there really having a look that nobody is getting out of the area?
We did have police quite involved during the very strict lockdown. In fact, police were there speaking to the rules at the same time as the public health, Ashley Bloomfield was. And in some ways, police were more strict than what the public health advice was. But I think they did that because they wanted to be in a position to have simple rules that could easily be enforced. And there's road checks outside of Auckland. When we have gone to a level 3 lockdown only in Auckland, you have to drive. It can take hours to drive out of the city because the police are stopping everyone and asking them where they're going and if they're allowed to travel or not. And I think shutting down this travel is absolutely essential to stopping the spread of the illness. But when we don't have a lockdown, as we don't now, we can travel anywhere. I was in the South Island last week for a conference in Dunedin. I went to a Greens conference in Christchurch. And the week before that, I was in Auckland for a big, So the good thing about being so strict about it is that after a few weeks, you can go back to normal.
I mean, that sounds really good and nice and perfect. And as far as you said, you would say to us, restricting traveling would be one part. Now, Sebastian and also I also explained a little bit how the situation is in Germany at the moment. We are now 1 year into this pandemic. We are in the middle of Europe. We have over 80 million people living in our state. You cannot advise us in details, but if you're thinking about this situation and comparing with your situation, which you had, and you were really, really successful, so congratulations. Do you have, I don't know, one or two tips which you would say, I mean, 1 year now in the pandemic, if you really want to do a hard lockdown, then I guess you would say better communication, but...
All I can say is that our very hard lockdown worked really well for us, and I'm really relieved that the government chose to go down that path, and I think maybe... The fact that Australia has done pretty well as well suggests that maybe we have some natural advantages down here where it's a smaller population, it's easier to control the flow of people, and also maybe like it's been summer here, so maybe we have higher vitamin D levels as well and we're like more immune. Mainly it's been just controlling the flow of people really, really well. So then we can open up, and then being really stringent on testing people at the border and controlling that. And that's been an expensive process. I mean, the managed isolation facilities probably cost almost $20,000 per person to do a 2-week quarantine. And we've only just started charging some people like $3,000 New Zealand. So it's taken a lot of resource from government, but it has really paid off, and it's been worth it to provide the financial support for people to be able to be safe, whether if they're coming in or out of the country and when they were staying at home. I think probably limiting travel in the midst of a really big outbreak is the only way to slow down the numbers. And then the other way, and this is, I have family in the United States. They've been in pretty much a lockdown for a year, so I know how challenging it's been for them. But it does seem like the vaccine, at least the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, are making a difference in the United States. And so maybe it would be easier to go that route at this point for Germany than to try and do a really strict lockdown for, it would take probably at least 6 weeks or possibly 2 months to really break the spread.
Yeah, and actually, we should do it then in whole Europe. if we
want. Yeah, yeah, you would have to do it. Like,
so I think getting more doses of vaccine would be really important, but there we're having a problem as well with our government that we're not having enough doses, and it's kind of really a slow process getting all the people vaccinated. So this is also really kind of really people getting really annoyed about that if you're looking at other countries, how fast they are in comparison to their inhabitants and how slow we as Germany are. So there we really, the government has to become better in this point, definitely.
Yeah, I have one last question here I would like to put to you about domestic violence. Was it an issue during the lockdown more than normally? Do you have any numbers on that as well?
Yes, and actually we have a great one. Our co-leader, Marma Davidson, is since the election, the first minister with specific responsibility for the prevention of domestic and sexual violence. Her work has been built on the previous undersecretary, Jan Logie, who's also a Green MP in the previous government, was the undersecretary, but now it's a minister. And we have a real problem with domestic violence in New Zealand. We have very high rates. It's really, really terrible. And there were a number of initiatives done to help ensure, like, for example, even in a lockdown, if you need to escape a dangerous situation, you are encouraged to do that. And there were some companies, like the supermarkets, put a special thing on their website, so that was quite under the radar, so that if you're in a situation where you have someone very controlling, trying to monitor your movements or what you're doing, and you need to ask for help, you can use the supermarket website in a really subtle way to say that you need help. So there was a lot of money and initiatives going into the prevention of domestic and sexual violence even before COVID. And that was, we were able to use that infrastructure to try and ensure that it could still be effective during a lockdown.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear, because this is an issue here as well, and we see it in the numbers now, also from the police, that this has been a big issue within the pandemic, and it needs to be addressed, to be handled properly and actually better. So, if I look at the things you've said during the last hour or so, if we take out the island thing, Germany won't be an island. This will not be possible. But I think there's at least a number of lessons to be learned looking towards New Zealand. You listened to the science. So science advisors were very important for you. You did a very hard and fast lockdown. You had simple rules, you said, to follow for the people, and you communicated it very well so that everybody felt a sense of a mission towards a common goal there. We can do it together, and a good framing there. And I think this might be an advantage as well. You had women as leaders, as politicians, as experts who advised you, and this might be of some good as well here to bring forward the whole thing. So I think there's quite a lot of things Germany can learn from New Zealand, and I'm very glad that we had the chance to talk to you tonight or this morning in New Zealand. And
thank you so much.
And thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. My pleasure. Thank you, and good luck. I hope things get better soon.
We'll try to do so, and good luck for you, your work, and hope to see you again in better times. And if you're around in Germany, come around to the Green Party as well. We'll be happy to see you in Saxony-Anhalt and in Bavaria. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Die große Anfrage. Ein Podcast von und mit Sebastian Striegel.